I'm James Lewis, the IBA's Director of Content. I'm speaking with Baroness Helena Kennedy, one of the world's leading human rights lawyers, a member of the House of Lords, and for a year now, Director of the IBA's Human Rights Institute. Helena, thanks very much for making the time to talk to me today.
Nice to talk to you, James.
So we're talking today on the theme of rule of law in the time of COVID-19. Now, the situation for me brings to mind extreme threats such as terrorist attacks like 9/11, when that balance between fundamental priorities of security and freedom very much front and center. Do you feel we're in a comparable situation, or are we in unique, unprecedented terrain with the pandemic?
Well, I think that we're in a unique position. I mean, there are similarities, of course, in that there are occasions in our societies and in democracies, particularly when you really do have to think hard about the ways in which you encroach upon individual freedom, which we cherish. And you have to say the interests of the public at large have to outweigh individual freedom. There were elements of that with regard to a percentage of the population back in the period of when the Patriot Act in the United States and where special anti-terrorist legislation was introduced in many countries, including here in the United Kingdom. So it's not an unusual thing to happen when there are those new challenges and where you feel that individuals who are being investigated, surveyed, and so on for the general protection of society, that there has to be a sort of shift in what one would expect in terms of policing. The difference between the limitations on our freedom that have been presented because of the threat of terrorism with the circumstances now is that it's actually affecting everybody. And so we're seeing a kind of erosion of our freedom in a way that most people are perfectly happy to make the concession that this is necessary, although they're finding it pretty tough. But it's encroaching upon our freedom of assembly, our freedom to move, our freedom to leave our homes. It's having a huge impact on the way in which we live our lives, because we're social animals and we want connection with people. And we want face-to-face connection with people. And it's very difficult for people to live in this very constrained way. But it's seen as being important to the safety of our nations and to prevent the death of those who are likely, in a severe case of the virus attacking their lungs, are likely to die. And so people, I think, are making that clear choice, which is that they are permitting, without much rancor, their states to take steps which are seen as being for the protection of all. While on the one hand, we're recognizing that balancing act where we want protection for individual freedom sometimes has to be constrained for the collective interest, there are ways in which states can really abuse this moment in time. And we're seeing it happening around the world. The main concern that people have at the moment is that special powers may be taken by the state, but they have to be limited in time. And there have to be clear ways of reviewing the exercise of those powers, and that there are special roles for Parliament, even if it's sitting virtually. There has to be monitoring of the use of the powers.
You have raised a very good point there about the importance of freedom of expression and the importance of getting accurate facts and information out there for the public in this specific situation of a pandemic and the health threat, the fundamental health threat of COVID. Of course, the first cases were in China, and these were back in December, as far as we know. But the scale of the threat only became apparent in March. And this was in no small part because of the suppression and silencing of whistleblower doctors, by which time, of course, it was pandemic. I'm just wondering, in a more general sense, what you feel this says about freedom of expression or lack of it, specifically in China, its importance and the devastating consequences, really, that's not an overstatement, when freedom of expression is suppressed.
One of the things that you know about an emergency like this, where there's a pandemic, is that people need to have good information. People need to be told by trusted sources that there are steps they can take to avoid becoming ill, and the ways in which they should be conducting themselves, and they should be told what powers the state is taking and what the consequences are. There should be real clarity about the position. And one of the things that happened at the very start of this whole pandemic is that China closed down opportunities of people knowing what was going on. It's very tempting for states to do this. They don't want there to be criticism. They don't want people to panic, they say. And so they don't give good information. Certainly in China, freedom of expression is not a freedom that is celebrated. And the government often is repressive about journalism and about those who are informing on abuses of power. There certainly was a silencing of those who were trying to let the public know what was going on at an early stage. And we're seeing that happening in other places too. The difficulty is that many places have taken this moment to actually seek to close down public information from reliable sources.
Obviously, in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic, free expression is important. Getting access to information is important. I just wonder if you feel there's a sense in which the devastating effect of China suppressing that information has highlighted the importance of freedom of expression more generally, that it should mean that when we come out of this very strange phase of lockdown, etc., that people do value trusted sources like the BBC and independent journalism all the more.
One of the projects that we've really put a lot of emphasis on within the Human Rights Institute of the IBA has been the Media Freedom Project, which is one that we are the secretariat for. It's run by UNESCO. 35 countries around the world have signed up to be engaged with this. It's looking at the ways in which journalism has been under attack in recent times, and it's reviewing the legislation and laws that are used to silence journalists, and it's also looking at the positive steps that governments around the world can take in order and to give greater protections to media freedom. If you don't have a free media, then you don't have access to information about abuses of power, about the ways in which you have rights and how you can exercise them. And you really do need good information to be an active citizen in a good society. So we see this as fundamental to all human rights and to all good law.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. So coming on, you started to talk about Hungary, but Viktor Orban was already a cause for concern. He's been attacking human rights and marginalised groups. We're speaking at the end of March. So yesterday, the parliament passed legislation that was going to give him even greater powers to rule by decree, putting in place an indefinite period of state of emergency. Just to ask you directly, Emma, how concerned should we be about that?
I think we should be concerned about the stance that Hungary has taken. Mr. Orban has been a source of concern to human rights lawyers and advocates around the world, because here was a country which we saw as being committed to the rule of law. And unfortunately, that has ebbed away. There have been serious attacks upon the judiciary and an undermining of the independence of the judiciary, an undermining of the independence of lawyers, you know, where lawyers who take up cases on behalf of asylum seekers or immigrants are really given a bad time. And they're often, if they're operating from within NGOs, which are reliant on charitable monies and the like, they are being driven out of operation in much cleverer ways than just, you know, the old-fashioned way of locking people up. What's happening is they're using the tax system to actually make it impossible for them to survive. And really, we're seeing the rule of law being seized and captured in the interests of an authoritarian prime minister. By taking these powers to himself without limit and without time prescription and without opportunity to monitor, it means that we don't know how he will use the powers. He's actually created a law which looks as though it's to prevent fake news. And the truth is, it could be used against straightforward journalism that is calling into question some of the things that government is doing.
And there's another one which is particularly draconian, which is people deemed to be interfering with a quarantine order could face 8 years in prison. I mean, this is totally disproportionate and really very extreme, isn't it?
Those sorts of sentences and the threat of them have a chilling effect on societies. You asked at the beginning how serious was this. And it's serious because it sends a message to the rest of Europe. other places in Europe are following in the footsteps of Mr. Orban. And it's quite interesting, and although it may not have been with malintent, a number of the countries have derogated from the European Convention on Human Rights. Armenia, Estonia, Georgia, Latvia, Moldova, and Romania have all stepped outside of the remit of the European Convention on Human Rights, saying that they need to do that in order to introduce the laws that they want to introduce to prevent people socializing, to prevent there being public gatherings, etc. The concern one would have is how long is that derogation, that taking yourself outside of the purview of human rights, how long is that going to go on for?
I just wanted to pick up on your point about Hungary and former Soviet bloc, really, is what you're talking about there. And I wanted to take you on to talk about Vladimir Putin in Russia, where he's been in power since 2000. That's longer than any of the country's leaders since Joseph Stalin, significantly. He's now seeking constitutional amendments to that could allow him to stay in power until 2036, which I assume you see as a major concern anyway. And he was looking to hold a public vote. It was scheduled for the 22nd of April. That has at least been put on hold due to coronavirus. I assume you welcome that being put on hold, but I suspect you may have broader concerns with regard to Putin and his use and abuse of power anyway, and extending that to 2036.
I'm very concerned about his interference in the constitution. Once you see leaders starting to give themselves longer terms in office, we should always be alarmed. And he tried it by a sort of cheating in the past. He moves between being president and prime minister in order to give himself another bite of the cherry. This is actually unpicking the constitution. We know the corruption of the state in Russia and its abuse of human rights on many fronts. And so I think that this should be another alarm call to us that the power of Putin is being extended.
Yes, and I just wonder if you feel that there is a danger that people like Orban start to look east, as it were, and that influence of the sort of Western European values of human rights, etc., start to drop away. I'm thinking that, you know, Putin's response to coronavirus, again, seems particularly draconian. And the parliament in Russia is reviewing legislation that could, for example, put people breaching quarantine in jail for up to 7 years. And it seems that Russia and Hungary are more in tune than perhaps Hungary is with some of the Western European countries.
There has been this very really disappointing shift. And we had, you know, celebrated the end of the Cold War. We had been rather, I think, over triumphalist about it. And of course, we let the free market rip, and it created a great deal of corruption, and in fact, a great deal of problem in many of those countries with people enriching themselves at the expense of ordinary people. So I think that the ending of the Cold War has not worked out the way in which perhaps optimists amongst us had hoped. And so I see this as a source of great regret, the way in which things are going. And I do think that Orban and others, the populists that are rising in Eastern Europe and, of course, in Central Asia, that they are acquiring power, and they still look to Russia, and what they see is something that should be alarming us.
Do you feel that Western Europe can have an influence on Putin, or is he going to carry on and as he will as an autocrat and you know, putting in place those powers potentially until 2036, that he feels he's somewhat untouchable and can claim a sort of field of influence, if you like, in that old Eastern Bloc?
Well, he seems pretty untouchable at the moment, and I do think that we're probably not helped by having a president in the United States who doesn't set a standard on the protection of human rights and so on. I also think that we're seeing a sort of impunity developing. I think that it's interesting that so far Orban has not derogated from the European Convention on Human Rights. I don't know whether that's just a mistake on his part and it will happen any day, or whether he basically wants to brazenly confront Europe under the Council of Europe that created the European Convention on Human Rights. But I think that in a way, I think he wants to have that battle because his interference with human rights has brought him into conflict with the European Union. And if this now brings him into conflict with the Council of Europe, the challenge will be what steps will they take to call him in line? And it may be that at this moment, many of the international institutions, the United Nations, the United Nations Human Rights Council, the Council of Europe, many of these international institutions at the moment are feeling somewhat beleaguered. And they're feeling that their power is being attacked. And I think that they perhaps even fear for their very existence. So I don't know whether they'll be prepared to take on Orban directly at this moment in time because of their anxiety that it might lead to many others disengaging.
Yes, major concerns there. So moving on, I mean, as with Orban and Putin, there are already concerns about Modi in India. So, for example, the citizenship law discriminates against Muslims, particularly problematic for those fleeing persecution, of course, by denying them citizenship. So it's no surprise, really, that in India we have Modi taking severe action, really severe action, regarding 1.3 million people, and they were ordered to remain at home for 3 weeks, and they were given just 4 hours' notice. I mean, this really does look extreme. Do you feel that's extreme, or is it desperate times call for desperate measures?
I think that we would say that challenging and difficult times call for taking steps that we wouldn't consider in ordinary times. However, what is happening in India is shocking and should shock the world. Here's one of the largest democracy in the world, which has a very, very huge poverty-stricken part of its population who are going to suffer enormously in this. And while Modi has said he's going to put money into helping to feed the poor, it's quite clear that many of the migrant labour who have come into the cities to work have been turned out of factories, turned out of the poor and crowded accommodation, and have been put on the roads to return on foot to the places from which they came with no food. And often it's women carrying their children. It's a shocking sight. And what we do know is that those poor people are not getting information. Most of their information comes to them because they have these cheap phones which they pay as you go, and that allows them to know what's going on. And unfortunately, they no longer have money to pay for phones to give them information. The other thing that Modi has done, and it should be a sort of great concern to us, is that he has been only too ready to turn off the internet. He turned off the internet in Kashmir and still not turned it back on. And he's talking about doing so soon because of the importance of getting information to people about how they shouldn't be socially mixing and there should be social distance. In a country which is so impoverished, where people live cheek by jowl, tend to a room and so on, to talk about social distancing, there's a certain nonsense in that. And there really is terrible punishment taking place. Beatings of people found by the police and army to be in the street. We really are not seeing a country which is in any way concerned about the human rights of its poorest. Well, let me just mention the business of Muslims. The new laws that were brought in, which were discriminatory against the Muslim population, gives an indication of how a nationalist, populist government, which is basically also sectarian in that it protects one religion as against another, that is a source of anxiety for the world. And we should be very concerned and highly critical of Modi, and yet we call him our great friend.
I wanted to come to the UK legislation, which you started to talk about. I mean, obviously, as someone who sits in the House of Lords, you've had sight of the legislation as it was going through. And I think at a point there were concerns that it was going to be in place for 2 years. It was brought back to 6 months and to be reviewed. But the UK legislation does bring in what is, I think it's fair to describe as unprecedented powers, unprecedented in peacetime, restriction of movement, as you've said, powers to shut down events, giving police wide-ranging powers. That's still working through. I think the police have talked about legislation made very, very swiftly, so there's an adjustment happening. It is in place for 6 months, which does seem like a very long time. Are you okay with the UK legislation?
Well, I was quite interested in the idea of trying to pull it right down to 3 months, but maybe that was over-optimistic. What we managed to get a commitment from government on was that there would be monthly monitoring of the exercise of the powers and what was happening, and that there would be a body created to do that. I got the impression it would be a body of MPs, a bit like a select committee, that they would be keeping the legislation under review. With the speed of legislation, it was only in the House of Lords, for two sitting days, and so we, in many ways, we couldn't push anything too hard. And once the government promised that they would do this, we accepted it in good faith. So let's just hope that that is going to happen.
There have been concerns, haven't there, about the way the police have been trying to enforce some of the spirit, if not the intention of the legislation. And Jonathan Sumption, former Supreme Court Justice, has been speaking about some of that. The police have been overstepping Dying Lakes Black, for example, to stop people swimming, which he felt was over-egging it a bit in stopping people exercising their right to exercise. What's your feeling?
It's such a silliness on the part of police to overdo this, particularly at an early stage. I do think that some of the steps that police have taken about not letting somebody walk their dog in a sort of fairly wilderness area and to contaminate a pond, I wonder how it will be decontaminated, just to prevent a person going into it. Not many people are going in to have a freshwater swim at this time of the year with the temperatures that there are outside, although the sun is shining. So I do think that it's overstepping their powers. There has to be a sensible discretion used by those who have these special powers. And I think Jonathan Sumption was right to call it out and to kind of have a warning shot across the bows of police. If they want public support on this, then you have to administer law in a sensible way.
Are you sanguine that that will happen, that the police were really put in a very difficult position because of the speed of the legislation and because it's extreme as well? Are you sanguine that that will settle down and common sense will prevail?
What you know is that there's a sort of instinctive rebelliousness that will pervade people after a little time of going stir crazy being at home. If they aren't able to exercise, they aren't able to occasionally go out, albeit on their own with a dog, then I think that you're going to get a lot of hostility to what is taking place. So I think it's important that the temperature of public compliance is understood and that the police should be pretty cautious. You know, give people warnings, make clear that certain things are unacceptable. People are still trying to get to grips with what the rules really mean. You know, yes. I mean, I was quite surprised to see that someone had gone to visit their relative for a birthday and didn't go into their house, but sat at the end of the gate to the house and sort of waved happy birthday and put a birthday cake on the step, and that was something that they were criticised for. So it seemed to me that, you know, there are some things that you can, you know, where you exercise your own restraint and you know, let those sorts of things happen.
Yes, that seems right, doesn't it? So it seems to me that when you're looking at legislation that's been undertaken in Hungary and you compare it with the UK, when you look at measures in India and Russia, you actually feel that the UK is responding to an extreme situation with extreme measures, but doing it under review, and that it's being done in a way that you feel actually makes the UK quite a favourable comparison with places like Hungary and Russia.
I mean, at the moment, certainly that's how it seems. We have to follow it carefully and make sure that there aren't abuses of special powers. And what we have to also make sure is that they're not that these powers are not used particularly towards certain communities or certain kinds of people. I'm concerned about how they might impact on the homeless and on people who have mental health problems and people. Asylum seekers in Britain receive very little state funding, and there's a special policy which is that asylum seekers should have no recourse to public funds. It's this sort of strict idea that somehow they're going to be abusing our welfare state. It's very hard to live off 30-odd pounds a week if you're not being, charities aren't providing you with food, and if you aren't also having the kindness of strangers. And that's not available now. Many of the charities are closing down. Many of the people who volunteer are not able to do that kind of work with asylum seekers. Many of the churches and synagogues and temples and places, mosques, they're not open either. The opportunities to support that meagre income is not there. So I would like to see a suspension of that minimum that's given to asylum seekers.
Some very good points there regarding the UK. Thank you very much. Moving on then, finally, just to talk about the United States. I mean, you referred to the sense in which Donald Trump as president has been abrogating any sense of world leadership or, giving moral leadership. And the Trump presidency really has seen 4 years of major rule of law challenges and issues. Attacks on the media, attacks on the judiciary, stirring up racial tensions. And we've seen it in the context of COVID-19 with constant references to the Chinese virus, declarations of travel bans, which were happening anyway, and also in the context of COVID. Are there any specific issues you find particularly concerning right now with regard to America and the Trump presidency?
There have been real problems for people on the borders. I mean, he's had a war against anybody coming in from South America, from Central America into the United States. And his war against those people has meant that genuine asylum seekers who are fleeing persecution, fleeing wretchedness, and who are coming because they're afraid and want the sanctuary of the United States, bring me your huddled masses, that he has made it clear that nobody is going to be allowed to even make an asylum application. Now, that is a contravention of international law. If someone arrives on your borders and is claiming asylum, then there's an obligation in international law to consider their application and so on. And he has made it clear that they're not going to be considered. It's gone without enough note that he has actually flown in the face of something that since the Second World War and the horrors of what happened to Jewish people at that time and to others, I mean, he's behaving in a shocking way. And so we should be concerned because, of course, the business of refugees is a problem all over the world. And the refugee camps are another place where there are real issues at the moment, James, because, for example, the internet has been turned off, as I understand it, in the Rohingya camps in Bangladesh. This business of being able to switch on and off the internet should also be a source of concern to us. When people are not getting that information, then, of course, their fears become even greater about what's going on in the world. I think that the United States has played a rather poor role in the way that it's handled this. I wanted, finally, to talk about the business of prisoners. There's a big push in the United States, as in many parts of the world, to release people from prisons. Prisons are the places which are absolutely going to be hotbeds for the passing of virus. And of course, the way to deal with it is you just lock people up in cells on their own, that you put them into solitary confinement. And if anything is going to cause damage to people's, not just their physical health, but their mental health, it's that. And so we should be concerned. And we in Britain and elsewhere should be releasing more and more people from prison. Isn't there a better way of dealing with this? Can't we review the business of so many of the women in prison? 80% of women in prison are there for non-violent offences. Isn't this a moment for us to really behave properly about how we deal with those who are in our inside our prisons? We're actually seeing this happening in lots of places that surprise us at this moment in time, in different parts of the world. So I really would like to see that happening here in the United Kingdom too.
Helena, thank you very much for that. Some really powerful thoughts there to round off on. And COVID-19, if nothing else, is making us think about, you know, what civilized societies are all about and revisiting those fundamental values that we all hold dear. So thank you very much for taking the time to talk through those issues.
Thank you.